And welcome back, everybody. We're talking with Michael Hoffman about his book, They Were White and They Were Slaves, about the inaccuracies in history, how this is being held out of the history books, and of course, how this is being used in current times for, political and other reasons. But I wanted to get into a little bit more about how you think that this has been managed to be held out from the history books. And I mean, certainly there are small passages, as you described in your book, you've pulled from other sources. It is there to a certain extent. But it's definitely been downplayed, and it's definitely been something that is not highlighted. It's not talked about. There are many descendants of white slaves in America today who even recently, when we started talking about ancestry on the program, some people looked into it and they discovered that they were the descendants of slaves who were brought to America and all that. So this is a huge topic, and it's never talked about. But from the point of view of the academics, how has this been performed? How could they keep it out from the history books in the manner that they have, Michael?
Well, I mean, the academics, and I appreciate the fact that many of them use rules of evidence. I mean, it's unfortunate that in this era of desktop publishing and websites that we do have quite a few right-wing myths circulating. In my newsletter, Revisionist History, this month, the title is Right-Wing Myths with an Endless Shelf Life, and I talk about ones related to 17th century British history that continue to be recycled. So it is good that academics have certain standards of evidence and research standards, which are often lacking in the right wing. People put up their opinions as authoritative. They take from this book, they take from that book. And there's a great deal of misleading going on in the right wing in many terms, almost as extensive as in the left. However, I think that we are dealing with a professorcracy, if you could call it that. It's an institution which is fundamentally left-wing, liberal feminist, climate change. And you could go all the way down the line of all of these dogmas, which many of them claim to be atheist, agnostic, and free of dogmas. And actually, they cling more to dogmas than ever before because they don't allow open debate. They don't allow challenges. They don't even allow advertising of books like mine, whether it's Usury in Christendom or They Were White and They Were Slaves. So and I think many of your listeners are aware of this, they operate in a narrow spectrum as gatekeepers. The good part of the internet is if we have knowledge is not power. I disagree with that. But the ability to detect fraud is power. And if people receive training in that and then access knowledge, then they can become independent of this gatekeeper phenomenon. But at the same time, all the internet can really do is point us to many of the great books that are being neglected in this day are no longer in print, but there are ways to access them, whether on the internet or at old bookstores or whatever. But I think that the vast majority of what we're seeing as the Oxford University Press, Cambridge, these university presses in the United States, and the mainstream book review companies, it's basically a conspiracy, a very loose one, but they maintain this dogma, and the dogma is of the evil whites, the evil Germans, and over here in America, maybe Europeans wouldn't agree with this, but we still see the evil Arab stereotype. I remember one lady sent a letter that I clipped out of a newspaper, and she said, and I wouldn't agree with her position, but she said the right to be anti-Semitic. And she said she had the right because, after all, are not Judaics in 99% of the cases anti-German, anti-Arab, anti-white? And, you kind of become aware of this fact that there are these politically correct categories of races and religions that can just be excoriated. And it's considered a human rights activity. And then when people try to mount a defense, and a defense that is more than just academic, because we are talking, as we did earlier, about mental health and defending against self-extinction. And so it's a very serious matter where the truth is there, where the truth is on our side, and we're trying to defend against it. And it just gets policed out by people who are largely careerists. They got into graduate school, they got their PhDs based on bootlicking, based on tailoring their views to the majority views that reign in these universities, and they're not pursuers of the truth. There are exceptions to that, but I have not yet seen it in relation to the subject of white slavery. There was a book out recently by Professor Brunsman who covered the history of impressment of white sailors aboard British ships. And he does a good job of releasing some raw information and primary research, but he embroiders it with this huge apparatus of apology for the British ruling class and minimizing the brutality that occurred with the whites. So occasionally you'll get a breakthrough there. I'm not entirely sure why. Maybe it's a process of serendipity, but I'm not really concerned with academia per se, because thanks to the internet and online sales of our books and people that we can reach all over the world, I think that we're seeing a very hopeful sign of a new category, and that is of the independent scholar. And I'm even seeing this from major publishing houses, where major publishing houses are resorting to publish independent scholars who've been given a good education, but they're interested in anomalies. And because these sell, and some publishing companies do want to make a dollar off this, they will get this out there. So I regard myself as an independent scholar, and I am supported by the people who buy my books. Unfortunately, due to widespread internet piracy, where my books are scanned onto the internet and then people charge for membership on these torrent sites, we do lose some significant revenue as a matter of that. But for people who are honest and buy the books, it keeps me going, and I'm sure it's happening with other independent scholars. So that's our hope. I don't have much hope for academia until we ourselves get the financial resources where we can found our own colleges and universities.
Yeah, well, exactly. I mean, this is an extremely important point to bring up, to not only support the researchers as yourself and many others who are doing the work and doing all of this, but gaining control again of the academic world, and or at least putting up something that can begin on an organized level challenge this. Because as long as there's all this division and we're focused solely on what our disagreements as opposed to our agreements, this is something that's going to work against us, I believe. So it's absolutely tremendously important, and financing is a huge part of that. And I wish there's some kind of concerted effort here in the future to take some steps in this direction. I know that different people have done this in the past to kind of pretty bad success rates to a certain degree. But yeah, I agree with you. It's very important to begin to organize in such a level that we can start to offer a viable alternative to this and have a stronger voice to that degree. Definitely. Now, I wanted to ask you a little bit more about the recent phenomena of not only political correctness, but also, racism overall, and how the word's invention goes back to the USSR, I believe, if those sources are correct. But it's a fairly new term, historically speaking. It's also a new moral issue that hasn't existed before. We're back to that old, conundrum again, where we view history with our current moral standards and apply that thinking upon, people 100, 200 or 1,000 years ago, which is a big mistake to make. But of all the laws in history of many of the great philosophers, as far as I've been able to tell, this issue hasn't been a major one. It's a recent, maybe, 100, maybe even less years that this has sprung into our world, and it stands as a new major moral, foundational aspect in our society. How do you think that this is being used, and is this done to a certain extent to exacerbate the issues of race relations, not only in America, but in other parts of the world as well, as we're becoming more and more multicultural in the West, as there's more cultural and religious, conflict on the rise along these lines, Michael?
Well, I think you're right about the genesis of this, although I might disagree with your conclusions. I do think you're absolutely right that 150 years ago, this was not on the radar screen of the leading intellectuals of our culture. But I do see a type of economic exploitation of poor white people that had racial overtones, and that might sound silly because the racial overtones were coming from the ruling class whites. But in order for them to justify the ruthless oppression and abduction of these poor whites who were then sent off into slavery and exiled, in order to justify that, they approached it in a quasi-racial way to say that this white underclass was genetic, it was hereditary, it was different from the white aristocracy of Great Britain. And on that basis, that was part of their justification. And in fact, in America, you had people like Caleb Cushing, one of the old line WASP members of the ruling class in America, referring to the Irish immigrants as having ape-like characteristics. He suggested their hands were like paws. And so, or for example, Amstead, who was the landscape architect of Central Park in New York, Frederick Law Amstead, took a tour of the antebellum South, and this is in my book, and he went down to one of the slave states, I believe it was in Louisiana, where he saw a boat being loaded and bales being thrown down into the boat, and it was the Irish who were loading the boat. And he turned to one of the supervisors and he said, "Why isn't one of those Irish guys going to be killed? I mean, it's very reckless the way you're throwing down the bales." And they said, "Oh, if one of the according to Frederick Law Olmsted in his book, if one of the paddies, as he referred to the Irish, gets their back broken, it's no cost to us. Whereas if we had to put a black slave down there, it would be a great cost in terms of this loss of life."
Yeah.
Well, justify that kind of racial treason, that kind of racial betrayal, a subclass was created about the Irish. And it's not just the Irish either, because sometimes the Irish try to guilt trip the English. You can also find it in the British ruling class against the poorer whites. I myself, being a Christian and being someone who is horrified by Orthodox Judaism, I love Judaic people, but I'm horrified by the ideology, as some of them are, and that's something that isn't publicized sufficiently. And Orthodox Judaism is all about the institutionalization of racism. And quite often when I see characteristics of racial supremacy being exhibited in the past in Western civilization, it has some type of Mamadian or Talmudic root to it. And white people themselves did not have a doctrine of racial supremacy and racial inferiority, as far as I have been able to trace it, until they encountered Orthodox Judaism, which largely did not happen until the Renaissance. But just a point that I would like to make.
Yeah.
I am opposed to racism for this reason. I believe that if the Holy Spirit comes down, I think it would be a rare occasion, but we have to be open to the Holy Spirit. And he directed a white person to marry a black person. It really was due to the Holy Spirit bringing them together, that has to be allowed to happen. It's a very controversial statement of mine. I've lost a lot of support for making that statement. But that's what I really believe as a Christian. And I feel that when people venture into the outer limits of racialism in defense of their own people, they're actually approaching what I find to be Talmudic ideology and doctrine. And that frightens me, because I spent a large part of my scholarly life exposing Orthodox Judaism, and I feel that it would be a betrayal on my part if I were not also to object to white racialism when it bears aspects of that, what I consider to be the most vicious type of racism there is, since the Judaic racism it cannot be mediated. I mean, Goyim have a stigma on them which is lifelong, and it cannot be resolved. And where certain white theorists approach that notion with regard to blacks or other races, it's very unfortunate, and I think that it's largely synonymous with Talmudic views. However, I do want to emphasize that this new sort of racism that exists among white theorists and intellectuals was not there 100 or 150 years ago. What I believe is that it's natural and it's normal to marry your own kind and marry in among your own race, and that there should not be pressure on people to drop that custom. That's a healthy custom. There's absolutely nothing wrong with it. I only think that there's something wrong when coercion is used to suggest that whites cannot cross a racial boundary if the Holy Spirit has really caused them to do that. And so I'm a critic of racism, but I do think that there is a hidden agenda behind it, because Judaic racism, Asian racism, and African racism has been policed out of the equation. And then it's not fair when you center only on what is largely an ad hoc defensive response on the part of whites to a situation where they've been constantly under attack. And I just want to parenthetically add to that I realize that there has been a British imperial racism, and there have been other nations that have institutionalized racism. I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about this self-defense racism, which has risen up because we're the race that's being targeted in terms of a media which encourages our women to miscegenate and encourages us to hate ourselves. And therefore, we have to distinguish between two types of racial reactions, one that would be a defense against that, and another one that would be a prop for colonial empires like the British Empire to say that we can conquer and colonize India because, after all, they're just wogs.
Well, you raise a very important point, I believe, and exactly, but what we're criticizing here is the application of guilt imposed on all white people, no matter, you know, even ethnicity and whatnot, due to the fact that they share the same skin color as those who were, let's say, behind the British Empire or behind some of their crimes. I believe that there were, aspect to this, of course, which did lead to, discovery. There are certain scientific, processes, that knowledge base that we do have, a lot to thank for in terms of, the expansion and everything else of empires and whatnot. There's not only a one-sided view we can hold of history. We wouldn't be where we are today for good or bad if what has occurred didn't occur. But nonetheless, the defense of this here is important because I think that there is a guilt now imposed on white people and the West specifically, with the application of course, political correctness from the left academic world that you mentioned. There are even white privilege conferences now where this is being sought to impose into the educational system so that very young people, white young people in school are going to be told that they are that they're oppressors by default, etc. So there is a response to this now, and I think that that's absolutely merited because of the nature of the attack of the system. And a follow-on from that, I think that there are also, as you said before, economic incentives here. You have, of course, things like affirmative action in America. We're getting to see similar kind of programs in Europe and in Sweden now as well, where whites are told that they're privileged, therefore they're held out from opportunities of education or employment due to their skin color. The double standards here is enormous, and I think it's one of those cases that if we could put the shoe on the other foot, people would realize what is going on, but for some reason that is not being done, and that's what I want to bring attention to,
I agree, and the white skin privilege thing is laughable when you look at history. In our previous newsletter, we did an article on some 80 white workers who were building the Grand Coulee Dam, and they died in the course of an 8-year period building this enormous monument. There's no memorial to them whatsoever. They died in various ways. It was unsafe working conditions. They've largely been forgotten. One local historian, I don't even think she's college educated, stepped forth with the naivete and the inspiration of people who have not been processed by college and university educations. It's important to go to university, but you have to take it cum grano salis, and many people just get absorbed by it. So it'd be hard, I think, for people to understand that the kind of hatred that's directed against poor whites in America. We have this redneck culture now where there's jokes told. You know you're a redneck if, and then the punchline to the gag is it's some level of mental retardation or incest, which is associated with being a poor white, which is a sea change even from the 1960s when Hollywood was largely reverential toward portrayals of poor and working class whites. Even in a kind of brainless comedy program such as the Beverly Hillbillies, Jed there, the patriarch of the family, was shown to have an innate sense of justice and to be a very good man, and there's no need to even maintain that any longer. But on the other hand, I want to address something that comes from the other side in order to fortify our people mentally and physically, because when I come across white racialist literature, they'll often celebrate our civilization. They'll say that, well, we are the people of Columbus, of Da Vinci, of Shakespeare, of Nelson at Trafalgar, Stonewall Jackson at Chancellorsville, Thomas Edison, the moon flights and all that. And, they don't factor in the malice end of this, okay? If malice enters the picture, it's portrayed almost solely in terms of like a malicious Judaic hand in history. And the triumphalist narrative, that's what it really is, it serves whites poorly in that it takes little account of the Judas factor that we've been talking about here, that the worst malefactors in the betrayal of our nation have been the white royals and the white capitalists. I mean, how did the current alien immigration of invasion come about?
Mm-hmm. Right.
You know, was it out of the blue? Are the roots of the treason and treachery only limited to Marxists or the past 50 years? Or is there a profound contempt for the way of life and liberties of the English working people that goes back centuries? So when we set up this triumphalist veneer on Western civilization, we're failing to see the thread of treason and subversion that has run all the way through that. I think we have to have a more revolutionary understanding of history rather than thinking, boy, if I could just go back to being alive in 1750, my life would be much better. If you were a working class kid in 1750 in London, most likely you're going to be out walking with your new bride somewhere in London, and you are going to be swept by a press gang with cudgels, and they're going to take you on board that ship, and she wouldn't see you again for 7 or 8 years. And if, as your ship was going into port at the end of that 7 or 8 years of abduction and naval slavery, if another ship with a press gang on it boarded it, imagine seeing land, sighting your home city, thinking that you could finally look up your wife if she's even still aware that you're alive, and now being taken off one ship and impressed on another ship. So this is something that really bothers me when I read about what people say about the conservatives of 18th century Britain, like Samuel Johnson, in terms of them supposedly upholding English liberty, which is then we are all the heirs of that in North America. That these actually English liberty goes back to the medieval period. So many of those conservative statesmen like Samuel Johnson were apologists for this naval enslavement. As I said, some 250,000 whites from 1688 until the end of the Victorian period enslaved in this way. What was the ideological root behind it? What is the capitalist animus that is motivating that? And was it really this idyllic time? It's so simplistic for our people, and I realize you're not saying this, Henrik, but it's so simplistic for our people to simply look on the past and say, I wish I was alive back then. Mm-hmm. Most likely you would not. You have a better fighting chance right now to exert your opinion and to organize than then.
Yeah.
Because of the American Revolution, which I have mostly positive take on. But that's my warning to people who want to adopt this triumphalist narrative. I think it's sown by the cryptocracy itself in order for us to fail to discern the fraud, the fraudulent thread that is running in through this left-right, black-white situation that has been established, where we have to choose sides and we end up as just pawns.
Yeah, it's an interesting point. You know, I think it's again, as usual, it's a fine balance between these issues, and it has to do with the recognition of reality, and of course, there's a lot of reactions due to the treatment here as well, and of course, that comes about, of course, when academics are saying that all whites did was that they stole from all these other cultures, and there's nothing really unique there, or what have you, so you end up in this kind of warfare really over history and the positions to kind of assert yourself in terms of what the accomplishments are. But, at the end of the day, reality is reality, wherever that may be. And that's what we have to look at and look at that balance sheet and see what has happened, what has been going on here. But I definitely believe you're right in terms of the economic incentives for what we're seeing throughout history. Today we see an expression of this with, wage dumping. We have globalization, of course, mass migration due to this. We have warfare in the Middle East, run by organizations like AIPAC and American foreign policy is completely controlled. So is British to a large extent. And this is creating tremendous conflict, on all over the world. And it has negative consequences, not only in the Middle East, but ultimately in, Europe now as well, as we see mass migrations and everything else. But I do believe that a lot of this is not then due to, free market, which is a misconception, as you clarified before, but indeed predatory capitalism, where they don't care at all about the people. They don't see these kind of lines or allegiances that people have, or the fact that they care about their country or where they're from, or to uphold their tradition or their culture or heritage or any of these things that quote unquote regular people, I guess, to a certain degree would kind of care about and want to see preserved. I think all of these things are very much threatened in our modern life with globalization. And of course, there's a tendency to try to reach back in history and find an anchor point of some kind of stability, Michael.
Well, I think that we look at here in the United States of America, the ruling class likes to pose as the friend of the Mexican immigrants against the evil white racists who don't want them in this country. But of course, they're not friends of theirs at all. They want cheap labor. They want this cheap stoop labor here in the United States in order to exploit these Mexicans. And I realize the Mexicans are thinking to themselves, well, eventually I'll get out of the stoop labor archetype and I will progress through American society. And that may or may not be true. But the driving engine, ever since the days of Leland Stanford, the railroad magnate, when he was trying to import Chinese coolies to build his railroads, has been this cheap labor drive. And yet you see now, when you look back at American history, we have these Chinese American historians saying, look at these evil whites who exploited the poor Chinese coolies on the railroads. Wait a minute, the Chinese coolies wanted to get in here. It was the capitalist barons of finance who brought them in against vociferous militant protest on the part of working class whites. Dennis Kearney in San Francisco, for example, told he marched a huge assembly of white workers up to Nob Hill, the wealthy district of San Francisco, and he told Leland Stanford that he would burn his mansion and all of Nob Hill, along with the ships in the port, if they did not desist in importing this coolie labor when native whites, Americans, needed those jobs. Yeah. And that's a key distinction which is policed out. Jack London is another example of somebody who is praised as a literary man like Dickens is, and he deserves the praise. I wish I could write half as well as Jack London does. But Jack London, his famous quote, I am a socialist. I am an up on my hind legs fighting socialist. But above all, I am a white man. And typically you get expressions like that coming out of working class guys who were not born with a silver spoon in their mouth, and they had to scratch and claw up through the capitalist system, and they saw what was happening to their fellow whites. I don't think it's motivated by hatred. It's motivated by a love of their own kind. One thing more I would like to add about the situation in Europe, which is I'm appalled by the extent of the immigration there and these crowded little places. I mean, Great Britain, yeah. I don't think it's any bigger than the state of Idaho where I reside. And we've got 2 million people here. But you know, how much of it is the fault of the yeoman whites? We talked earlier about the white yeomanry of Great Britain upon whom Alfred the Great depended. Where is the yeomanry of Great Britain in terms of resisting this immigration?
Yeah.
A lot of them are in front of their TV sets, or they're more obsessed with what we call soccer and they call football, and the sports mania, which the cryptocracy has managed to addict them to. And they also, I've been over to England a few times, and when there's a large Pakistani family that moves into the neighborhood, the native English will say, here comes that regiment of a family. And I have several children, and so I lean over and I say, what's that? What do you mean, regiment of a family? Oh, the guy's got 8 kids. And, you know, I can be fairly brash sometimes, and I spoke right up to the fellow, and I said, well, maybe you should have 8 children.
Yeah, exactly.
And maybe if you did, and it was an overwhelming population issue, that these people wouldn't stand a chance in terms of the immigration. They might come over in a nation that was overwhelmingly white and was reproducing at a high replacement level and say, you know what, we've been here a year, we're really not welcome, they've been kind and decent to us, we're going back home. That may sound naive, but the bottom line for me is, whatever is best in our civilization has been truth and justice. We've tried to exhibit that towards ourselves, and we need to maintain that as a bottom line, even with these other races, because the goodwill of these other races, we are minorities on this earth today. We need the goodwill of the best people in the other races. And therefore, our standard cannot be race. That's a retrograde standard. Our standard has to be truth and justice and our civil and human rights to our land, the land that our forefathers fought for, while also acknowledging those same rights for these other peoples and rejecting imperialism and colonialization. I think that's two parts of a strategy for success, which I'm not seeing in Europe right now, which I find is mostly blame the colored for a degeneracy and perversion that exists within the white race itself, and including in the Masonic and royal networks of Great Britain, which is not at all a target, as far as I've seen reading the literature of the National Front or the BNP or whatever this new group is, UKIP or whatever it is. I don't see that at all.
Interesting point there. I want to ask you about that a little bit later here in terms of what you think is the origin point of this, but the relationships, I guess, between the races here in the current climate as we see it, that is not something, you know, the charitable, the you know, the kind of the good-hearted relationships, I don't think is something that is going to be fulfilled at all if we look at the manipulation of history and the media and the guilt that is imposed on whites, or even, you know, I see that everywhere now. It's like whites are the problem. You know, they're the poison of the world, and they've done all of these things to ruin it for everybody, and we're like better off without them. And, you know, all these very, very violent kind of exclamations against people who are white just for the sake of it. And that is definitely not going to help the situation. It's going to exacerbate it. And it's something that frankly worries me. If indeed, if we look 2-3 generations down the line in a country like Sweden, or of course Great Britain as well, but France has a lot of immigrants, Germany does too, and we might be looking at a situation here where, you know, in 2-3 generations the demographics are going to be completely different, and we're going to be minorities in our own countries. And the question, of course, is if this, I don't believe it's going to happen, but if it happens, are we going to be treated with charity? Are we going to be treated nice? Or is there going to be a malice at the root of this here, a kind of a vengeance that lies at the back of people, maybe even subconsciously programmed into them by the type of things we see in the media right now, in the movies, etc.? Is what's going to happen there, do you think?
Well, I think that you're right. I don't think there's any doubt that there would be a revenge motif that would come into effect. I mean, we're even seeing revenge when the Islamic State called ISIS, which may or may not be CIA-backed or funded at some level, but we see them immediately blowing up the tomb of Jonah the prophet, which was revered by the more normal Muslims and, of course, by Christians. We forget that Muslims had protected that tomb of Jonah for centuries, and that Muslims have lived on good terms with Christians in Palestine for hundreds of years. It's basically been this Zionist factor with the West allying with Zionism instead of just at the very least staying neutral and sending medical supplies and humanitarian aid to both sides. Having taken a side there, we've created a situation where another type of Islam is coming to the fore. It's always been there, the Wahhabi type of jihadism has been a germinating factor, but always at a very marginal and low level. It's now come to the fore, I think, because of what some tactics of the CIA and strategies of the CIA in Afghanistan, which largely created the Taliban. I wonder if at a deep level we don't also see that in Islamic fundamentalism. I saw a photograph, and I have it in my files, of Osama bin Laden when he was a teenager, and his very wealthy family was touring Sweden.
Yeah, allegedly. Do you think that's true, that claim?
Well, they were touring Sweden. I mean, unless you think it's a fake photograph, is that what you're saying?
I don't know. I heard that it was a question, and I looked at it, and I was trying to find some more, you know, sources for it, and I don't know. I ended up questioning the legitimacy of it for some reason.
Okay, well, that's interesting. I'll take that into consideration. Well, what I was about to say is they were wearing bell bottoms and secular attire, but I will say I have contacts among the Christian Palestinians. I have two friends. One's born in Bethlehem and the other in Nazareth, and they kid each other about who has more bragging rights. But they grew up there, and their parents have told them stories about the decency of the Muslims. I know another fellow who comes from Syria, although he was raised in Lebanon. The honesty, the family values, how on St. George Day, the English sometimes forget St. George is an Arab, honored by Muslims and Christians. On St. George Day, the Muslims would go in the mosque to worship the Christians in the church, and then they'd have a big party in Palestine afterwards honoring St. George. There has definitely been a radicalization of the Muslim masses due to a lot of hidden factors. But my point is this, is that what we have is an issue here, and you're probably not going to agree with this because it's a fundamentally Christian insight, but I believe that there are certain crimes that no race can commit, without being aware that we can't just deal in these symptoms. We have to go to the source and root of it. And when you are destroying en masse on the level that we ourselves have done, and we have to take responsibility for it, not blame others, on the level of abortion and birth control, you look at these beautiful white women, handsome white men, the children that they could birth into the world. I've been at several births. It's probably the most beautiful thing I've ever seen, is a baby coming fresh from the hand of God. And to think that these children have been destroyed by whites, there's going to be a price to pay for that. And the biggest price to pay will be a lack of self-respect. So many of us, like you and I, we love our people. We want to encourage in them some sense of self-worth and some fighting instinct. And yet we're so frustrated by the fact that we see them just getting punched and getting punched. And they seem to be saying, yeah, give me more. Give me more. I love it. Well, what's the root of that? Is it a rot inside their souls, knowing that to whatever extent, either personally or in a family situation, they have condoned or permitted or been engaged in abortion or birth control, which is largely not even on the outrage meter of a lot of people? So that has to be factored in. And until we see a reversal of those rates, which is the most fundamental criteria of whether or not we respect ourselves, I believe that these other symptoms are going to continue on.
Yeah, well, I agree with that completely. I mean, this is imposed on primarily white people, you know, from Planned Parenthood. You have, of course, you know, feminism and the type of kind of progressivism that we've seen in the West on the rise, which have, you know, shattered family relations. I mean, look at a country like Sweden. They're absolutely, completely confused when it comes to, I mean, I don't even like to use the word gender roles, because that's part of this, you know, academic kind of environment that we're talking about. But between the sexes and the schism that has occurred there and the radicalization in that regard of a lot of these feminists, and, you know, you have organizations like SCUM there, the Society for Cutting Up Men, things like that. I mean, it's completely out of hand. And I believe that this has been done on purpose as well. This is part of, you know, guilt imposition on white people. It's propaganda from the media that tells them, you know, oh, you're you know, don't be with your own race, kind of thing. That's like of the past now, and things like that. Or don't even have kids because you want to, you know, as a woman, you want to climb the corporate ladder, or you don't want to serve men and things like that. So there's a lot of these circumstantial diseases that is being imposed on people in the West, I believe. And this is done, I think, for specific reasons. And you might agree with that or not, Michael, but I think that this is something that it's been imposed on us for some reason. Of course, what we can question is, why has it been successful? Why have we been allowed ourselves to be manipulated by this? You know, that's the big question.
Yes, because when you say imposed, it's been imposed to a certain extent, psychological manipulation and so forth. However, we're not living, Europe and North America is not living in a Chinese realm, so that there is no law saying we must abort. There is no law saying that we must practice birth control. Therefore, I would like to see a greater sense of introspection on ourselves. And some of this is a spiritual dimension. Whether people are Christians or not, I'm sure that they understand they have to cultivate a relationship with the one who created them and with their own spirit, to look inside themselves and say, to what extent am I the cause of this evil? What is it in me that has made me vulnerable to these impositions? Because since there is no law, and even though it's difficult without a lot of money to be able to have a large family, nonetheless, you know, I'm thankful enough to my creator, and I'm thankful and I'm loving my race enough that I am going to reproduce myself. And reproduction level is just 2.2. You can't have 0.2 tenths of a child, but you can have three. And if every family did, then, you know, we would be in a lot better territory. The second point I wanted to raise with regard to Europe is, and this probably be subversive to some of your listeners, but it's kind of from a revisionist perspective. You know, as you know, I've been a World War II revisionist for quite a while, and I'm in touch with many of the revisionists who've been persecuted for their views, where in Europe, asking questions about homicidal gas chambers can run into criminal and civil penalties and imprisonment. Yep. And so from the perspective of some of the revisionists who've been imprisoned, let's also remember that a lot of these golem whites are oblivious to the fact that their fellow white historians are going to jail for questioning what is essentially relics. You know, a lot of people would never stand for anybody being in prison for questioning a Catholic relic. But if you question an Auschwitz relic, they just shrug their shoulders and go along with it. David Irving imprisoned in Austria for approximately a year, Ernst Zundel in Germany for 5 years. And Robert Faurisson, I'm sure you're familiar with his work, the great French revisionist, told me that when he was in jail prior to the strong Muslim immigration, the white guards would either be indifferent to him or somewhat abusive to him, since they regarded him as a devil, the way he had been demonized in the Zionist media. However, he said in his last trips into incarceration, some of the guards were Muslim guards. And when they found out why he was in jail, he got extra food, he got better treatment, and they would even stand outside of the cell and ask him questions and talk to him. Hmm. Now, there's a sea change there in terms of, is possibly God as a punishment on a group of people who have rejected his law and his will turning to another group of people? I don't know. I'm asking the question, but I have to say that Ernst Zundel's treatment in some of the white jails here in America by white guards was horrendous. And I've gotten some very decent treatment from black and Muslim people. So who knows? You know, God works in strange ways, and we better look to our own house to reform it first before we go pointing fingers at others.
Yeah, no, I agree with that. I think that there's, I don't know if we want to put it on this level, but that there are, I guess, common enemies here in that regard. I mean, what I'm seeing in Europe right now is definitely an entice. I mean, if we look at organizations such as, you know, EDL and even the Swedish Democrats, although I recognize that what they're trying to do is to curb the immigration that we see, they're trying to, in the regards of Swedish Democrats, they're trying to reform the wrongs in this within the system that disincentivizes people from actually having you know, children. There are things there that they're more concerned with economy. They think about other things perhaps in a different manner for various different reasons than perhaps others would. They have there maybe it is a religious thing. They're told to have a lot of kids, so they do, and it doesn't matter what the environment is like or if there's economic prosperity or whatnot. While whites and Europeans have another view on that. But nonetheless, I see that these organizations are, yes, they're on one level trying to do something about it. They're reacting to something which is occurring. But then at the same time, I see that these are being used. We can see very pro, Israeli sentiments with a lot of these organizations. They do stand with Israel. I think that there is another hidden objective here, which is, of course, to create conditions of massive conflict between Christians or secular Europeans and Islam, and to a certain extent have that third party in the equation see these two forces fighting each other, where they can sit back and maybe look forward to securing a greater Middle East or something like that. I don't know, that's kind of a conspiracy view, but I definitely see that there are other motives behind what we're seeing in Europe right now, Michael.
Yes, indeed.
Now, let's return here. There's, of course, so many things we could talk about that, but let me ask you to kind of return to the other question here a bit. So who worked for the push to end slavery, and how were finally the white slaves freed in this equation here, Michael?
Well, I mean, we never really did have a William Wilberforce. It was actually a set of historical circumstances, because as the United States of America became settled and as the American revolutionaries succeeded in their war with the British Crown, you then have an entirely different set of legal jurisprudence coming into effect, so that it was much more difficult to enslave people ad hoc. So much of the enslavement of whites that we're talking about here was completely off the books, very much like impressment of the British sailors. Because we have the legal trail. You can follow the legal trail in the various cases as people who had been impressed brought court cases in Great Britain. And the consensus of the judges was there really isn't a precedent in statute law. This is largely the prerogative of the king, the will of the king, basically on his ipse dixit, in other words, on his say-so. Well, once the American Revolution came in, there's no longer this monarchy. George Washington rejected a kingship. And so you had a different set of laws in effect. You also had a different set of economics, to be quite frank, because the original industry, the original crops in which the white slaves were employed, which was sugar and tobacco, had now been, by the later part of the 18th century, eclipsed by cotton. And cotton had been increasingly worked, as you know, by the black people. And so whites were, first of all, the original slavery in America was land clearing, swamp draining. It wasn't, there weren't even crops in yet. And that's what white slaves were doing. And if you've ever done any of that work, and I've done a little bit of it as an ex-farmer, you know that it's just very difficult, very demanding type of work. I mean, just it's backbreaking. And so they were used for that. And then in the 18th century, you had the actual indentured servitude coming more to the fore with the success of the American Revolution, so that a legal structure was in place for people like Andrew Johnson, who we discussed earlier, the future vice president of the United States. And so it more or less evolved into indentured servitude from chattel slavery, largely because of the American Revolution, and because you now had enough of a white labor force that was in a type of bondage that was more contractual rather than chattel slavery. So I would say that you, and I've always recommended this to my students, is that you have to look at this century by century. The 17th century was very different from the 18th, the 18th from the 19th. And so we had a gradual dying out of this. And then the so-called convicts, as white slaves were called, always some euphemism, criminal, convict, vagrant, all those terms were used. Then the mise-en-scene of white slavery moved to Australia, and that was really the last vestiges of a process that had begun with the kidnapping of whites off the streets of England. And then, of course, as the Australian listeners to your program will know, that died out in the middle of the 19th century. So we didn't have any William Wilberforce, but those William Wilberforce types were very, very hypocritical, because not only were people like Wilberforce and Samuel Johnson content to see white children enslaved in mines in England and in as chimney sweeps, but they also had no protest against what I'm talking about here in terms of the mass impressment of the white working class aboard the ships of Great Britain. Again, no protest there. They were largely blind to the inequities that were imposed upon their own people. And that's a moral failing and a spiritual perversion.
Well, thank you so much for coming on the program again, Michael, talking with us about your book, They Were White and They Were Slaves, and of course your thoughts on some of these other issues connected to this topic. It's a broad one. We could go on for much longer, of course, and discuss how this applies here to today. But do you have any additional thoughts before we close up here? And of course, if not, also tell us about the website again and give us some of the titles of the books.
Well, thank you for having me today, Henrik. And the website is www.revisionisthistory.org. And then you'll see that we have a printed catalog that people can access, or they can go to our digital store if they have a credit card they can use. And we also have many books for sale there, as well as our newsletter, which is published 6 times a year. And my last book was Usury in Christendom, the mortal sin that was and now is not, because as a Christian, I believe that the love of money is the root of evil, and tracing that love of money and how it arose in the West, largely through the degeneration of the church. And then the book I'm working on right now, The Occult Renaissance Church of Rome, which touches on a lot of conspiracy issues as well. So that's about it. And thank you very much for being here today.
Thank you. Really appreciate it. Revisionisthistory.org. And of course, keep an eye out for the new book there on the occult renaissance as well. We'll see if we can get you back as well, Michael, talk about that. Keep us posted. But of course, keep up the good work. Great having you here.
Okay, thanks.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, that's our program for today. I hope you have some new things to consider and learn some new aspect that you didn't know about before. We have John Rappaport, Kevin MacDonald, Dennis Fetcho, John DeNugent, Veronica Clark, Susan Lindauer, and others with us ahead. Well, thank you for listening today. I hope you have a great rest of your day or evening, wherever you are. And of course, my thanks to the team and to you for subscribing. We will speak to you soon, so take good care, and we'll see you later.